The question is, what is the link between two apparent facts? One, the spirituality of man. Two, the physical evolution of life on earth, which appears to show no spirituality or ethical content. In the evolutionary process, we observe growth towards the fulfillment of purpose in all the different species of creatures and throughout the activities of what we are pleased to call the material universe. But science has now begun to show quite clearly that there is no such thing as a real separation between what we call material and what we call immaterial. The interconvertibility of matter and pure energy is an established fact. Throughout the centuries, throughout the millennia, we human beings have necessarily, we couldn't help it, separated matter and spirit, mind and body. But at the turn of the century, we began to enter the realm of the subatomic world. And then we discovered quite clearly that there was no impassable gulf between what we call matter and what we call pure energy. The gulf was there because we, being developed only to the extent that we have developed, were unable to cross the barrier and realize the utter unity of that which we called the spirit or pure energy, pure creativity on the one hand, with what we called matter. Dead matter was the phrase we used, you see, on the other hand. Now you see, the split lies in our consciousness. And because the split lies in our consciousness, and we are still incapable of being conscious in terms of totality, in terms of the actual wholeness and unity of the universe, therefore, our minds, as we call them, functioning as they do through our sense impressions and the conditioned, limited activity of our brain, saw all the phenomena of the universe, including the phenomena which man displays, as being antagonistic to each other. We thought of man as trying to have some ethic, and the evolutionary process in nature as having no ethic. But you see, we are trying to apply, to use our limited standards in order to judge the totality. You know very well how man has the power to accept, truly accept, with complete compassion and wisdom, those who do evil. If we do not accept them and separate ourselves from them, there is no chance of healing them. In order to be able to consider together to have the patience, to have the wisdom and the skill to heal that which appears to be evil, that which appears to be diseased and sick, needs this type of consciousness which includes the totality. And this is by no means an easy task. Therefore, through the ages, we have seen life on earth as showing no spirituality. But now, look at it another way. Supposing life on earth did not present a situation which appears to be full of conflict, which appears to be such that there can be no relationship between that and the spirit, then there is nothing to do, so to say. But if there is manifestation, there is a purpose in manifestation. And that purpose comes within the scope of our vision and understanding when there is this tension produced. And we begin to search our own ignorance, our own drawbacks. And when we discover them, we begin to see complete relationships. And when we begin to see complete relationships, then we completely transcend our relative dualistic ethic and see ethic manifesting, coming to fruition through anything and everything and every type of phenomenon. The phenomena which cause us distress, horror, sorrow, suffering, they all have their part to play. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. It's very difficult, admittedly, very, very difficult indeed. Because if you try to apply this sort of understanding to solve the problems which the world situation poses before us, you will find it practically impossible to do anything about it. But here, the real solution lies in being truly practical. Now, to be truly practical means to be truly ideal. We have ideas which are limited, which are constricted, which are faulty. And because of all that, all the activities following, emerging out of those ideas are faulty. Take a simple case. An engineer wants to build a bridge. Or he's got the orders to build a bridge. Very well. His mathematics, first and foremost, have to be perfectly correct. If there's any flaw in his mathematics, that flaw will be the source which will cause the collapse of that bridge sometime or other. But if he has the perfect mathematics, if he has the perfect material, which means the ideal mathematics, the ideal material, then that bridge will stand. It won't collapse. And that is the practical thing, isn't it? Now it is the same, or something similar at least, in all our spheres of life. The spiritual, the psychological, and the material. I use separate words, but then our languages all over the world are so limited that we have to use words which invariably bring about a separative context. You can't help that. But once you awake to the fact that words do that, and our ordinary concepts always do that, once you awake to that fact, then you make due allowance, and you begin to see your vision, in other words, becomes clear, and it transcends the limitations of what are apparently insuperable difficulties in your way. And then one can actually live that compassion and wisdom. and see the purpose, the special ethic which applies to the terrible situation. Now here is a question which was sent to me enclosed in a letter. And although it is not quite relevant to the material of the talk today, it has some bearing on it. Zoroastrians do not try to convert others to Zoroastrianism. But how are we to prevent young children living in the United Kingdom from being converted to Christianity when schools, churches, and various evangelical zealots, I'm glad that phrase has been used, try to brainwash our children to accept Christianity as the only true religion and everything else is false? One answer is to go back to India, but what if one has to live in the United Kingdom, which is designated officially as a Christian country and not a secular state like the United States or India? First, as far as I'm aware, having been a school teacher myself in this country, the parents could tell the headmaster or headmistress, "We are Zoroastrians, and therefore let my children be free not to attend the morning assembly or the religious instruction class." Unless the religious instructor is one who is well versed, truly versed, not somebody whose conditioned mind has already prejudged the issue, but who is truly versed in the deeps, not the superficialities, in the deeps of all the great religions of the world. Now, if he were to teach the children and present to the children what is at the heart of all the great religions, then we would have no objection to the children attending that class. But otherwise, we would request you to excuse them that period, during which they can do something else which is part of their school work. That is one aspect to it. There is another point, which is a deep point. If we are intelligent, we would not try to prevent our children from being converted. If father and mother are themselves real examples, living examples of Zarathustrianism, in the deep sense, not merely in the external sense of ceremonies and rituals and doctrines and dogmas and so forth, but if we are living examples of true Zarathustrianism, then that will be the most powerful influence working upon the whole consciousness of the child. You have no idea how powerful this influence can be in the real sense. And it will be an influence which, like the beneficent influences of nature, air and light and so on, which bring the seed, which enable the seed to become a plant, and let that plant naturally and spontaneously grow into its full state, so that it is the perfect flower. Now, then your children will be the flowers of the Spirit through your nourishment, which works principally unconsciously upon them. And this unconscious working, because your own consciousness and life is the truly Zarathustrian one, is of immense potency, and it does not condition the mind of the child. This is very, very important. It doesn't limit it. And therefore, that child grows more and more easily and naturally towards its fruition as a human being. As far as my own view is concerned, there is nothing to choose between the great religions. Where the depths are concerned, there are different facets of the one supreme truth, the supreme reality. And there are different facets only in this sense, that the particular formulation given to this fundamental truth, the supreme reality, necessarily has to be different from another formulation because of the limitations imposed upon our existence by the nature of the times in which we live, by our socio-cultural heritage, by the various conditioning influences in the daily affairs of the nation or state to which we belong. And therefore, there are bound to be differences. In formulation, only in formulation, thank goodness that there are these differences. What a dull universe it would be if there was absolute uniformity everywhere. This is the marvel and mystery, the wonder, the beauty of the entire cosmic process. The infinite variety, the multitudinous of that variety in manifestation. And this is what makes life so rich and also awakens us to the fact that the eternal, the immortal, the infinite, God or Brahman or Ahura Mazda or whatever name you like to give it, is truly the one most worthy, the most worthy one. That is the original meaning of the word Aryan, the worthy one. So you see, don't worry about this being converted from one religion to another. Be perfect Zarathustrians yourselves, and you will have done the best. You can't do better. So you needn't run back to India. Here is one other question. Which really deserves a complete afternoon to itself. and I'm I shall say a few words about this simply because I did mention in the course of the talk this afternoon about being in the meditative state. Could you elaborate on what is meant by the act of meditation? This is one of the peculiar mistakes we all make in relation to the word meditation or in relation to the word prayer. We can't help doing that because we don't know anything better at the moment. If you look into the in the dictionary, you will find the word meditation defined as musing, as thinking about some deep ethical or religious subject, paying attention to ontological problems, that is, the problems and questions which arise as to the fundamental nature of being and so forth. Now, this is a very misleading definition. Meditation has nothing to do with musing. Musing is silent talking in your own brain. It is not only silent talking, it is daydreaming, indulging in fantasy. This has nothing to do with meditation. The word meditation is used in the English language and other European languages and so forth to represent the original word samadhi. But samadhi, sang-adhi, means the supreme togetherness, the absolute oneness of the actual universe in its totality. The oneness which is realized through you in consciousness by the totality. It is God, totality, transcendence, who or which meditates through you, because your mind is still, it is quiet, it is offering no obstruction to the power, the beauty, the benevolence, the creative action in eternity of the transcendent itself through you. Otherwise, we are constantly blocking it by self-preoccupation. So you see, meditation in that sense, the true sense, can never be an act. We start that way because we get interested in this and we begin to get stimulated and we wake up. Oh, yes, if I were to practice meditation, then I will be doing the right thing, the good thing. Up to a point, that is true, but that is absolutely the kindergarten stage. In fact, it's almost the stage before you go into the kindergarten class. It's between birth and kindergarten. So, you set a certain time apart, you set a place apart for practicing meditation, for practicing contemplative prayer, as the Western world also calls it. Contemplative prayer. But after you have started with an act like that, and if you inquire into the real nature and meaning of this act, its significance, and whether it has any real fruits, you begin to discover that all you are doing is conforming to a fixed mode of discipline which has been imposed upon you, either because of your willing consent or because you feel that this is the way I will realize the supreme bliss and happiness. And it is precisely that outlook, that attitude, that I will realize bliss, I will be one with God, which completely defeats the whole process of meditation, the whole process of prayer in its deep sense. You see, we have sort of turned the whole thing upside down. It is totality, it is transcendence which meditates and prays through you. This is the important thing to bear in mind. And it is only you, I, a human being, who on this planet, at least as far as I know, can be the Holy Grail, to use a Christian term which is very, very expressive. The Holy Grail through which God can fulfill Godhood as perfect manhood. This is something very different, isn't it? So, do not regard meditation as an act. It will start like that. But realize that that has to grow into something else. And as long as we impose any fixed ideas or disciplines upon ourselves, then we merely fossilize. There must be change. And the change mustn't be fortuitous. It mustn't be regressive. That's why I started with the three aspects of change. It has to be progressive. And the progressiveness is not a case of from here to there. Because in infinity, where is here? Where is there? It is all here to start with. And in consciousness, you realize totality, infinitude within the finite self. And this is one of the miracles of the universe which constantly keeps taking place. And then second, you said during your talk, this refers to another talk which I gave at Westminster, that the answer to the following question, what is the most powerful and effective means of dealing with evil, is our names. Could you please fully explain the concepts behind this? Fully explain is a tall order. But let me put it briefly this way. The names of Ahura Mazda, the names of God, if you take Judaism, you have Elohim, Yahweh, El Shaddai, Adonai, and all sorts of names like that, you see. In the other great religions also, you have all sorts of different names given to the one supreme total reality. Now, what do these names actually, in actual fact, the fact of manifesting energies, what do they typify? They stand for the various archetypal forms universally present, universally active, of the one primordial creative energy which remains everlastingly for us the mysterious, unknown and unknowable by thought, by concepts, by the brain. If you look into all the great pantheons of the world, you will find that the great gods, as they are called, and the goddesses, and so forth, they stand for these archetypal forms of the one primordial creative energy. And they manifest through us in the main psychological ways which distinguish our psychological functioning as such. Let me put it this way too. A human male can know fatherhood, and the female can know motherhood, and similarly all the different relationships. Now, each human being can know all those, can know the relationships which belong to him or her as such, but they are universal too. And it's the universal aspect which is called the immortal aspect. Now, to these different aspects of the archetypal energies as such are given the names of the great gods, of the archangels, the angels, and so forth. That is what those names stand for. So that they are not mere names which have only a kind of a very secondary meaning and hardly any power behind them. These are actual energies functioning throughout the universe and in man. Insofar as a man is sensitive and capable of being awakened to them. So when Ahura Mazda says, the most powerful means for dealing with evil in the world is our names, but our texts are so limited, particularly the Zarathustrian texts, which is a great tragedy. They were destroyed by the so-called great conquerors, miserable people conquerors are. You see, there are no explanations given like this throughout the Zarathustrian texts anywhere. We have to search them out, and this is where the deep study of other religions, and far more important than study, the actual practicing in inward investigation, so that all our mistaken ideas gradually vanish away like morning dew when the sun has arisen in full splendor. And then we shall find that as we investigate that, these powers for beneficence begin to operate through us. And therefore, that which is discordant, troublesome, miserable, evil in us is transformed into good. You can't get rid of evil. You can't. Nothing in the cosmos can be thrown out of the cosmos, but it can be transformed. That is what you can do. You can transform the evil, the dualism, the ambivalence of the psyche, and make it a complete whole, holy. After all, what we call evil only is an unfortunate expression, a distorted expression of your own living psychical energy. If you take a physical analogy, if something is wrong with your heart, you don't cut it out and throw it away. You can't. That'll be the end of you. Similarly, where the psyche is concerned, because the psyche has no separate special organs, you have to deal with the phenomenon which is concerned with your psychical energy. And your psychical energy is intimately bound up. It is only another way of talking of your whole electrochemical energy in your whole organism. You see? And you can transform that. This is where the whole business of the discipline of the holy life comes in. Discipline not in the sense of conformity to something imposed, but discipline in the sense of growing and learning happily.